Good morning. Welcome to a special Fun Drive edition of the Roundtable Panel. I'm Joe Donahue. It is Monday, the 8th of June. I hope you had a beautiful weekend, and we welcome you to our sojourn here in trying to figure out what's happening in our world, and we do so with a wonderful panel this morning, just an embarrassment of riches, and we are thrilled to introduce them to you. In the meantime, please keep your eye on the prize as far as making money. We need you desperately. 1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. We'll be with you for a little bit, and then we'll go back over to Pledge Central, and then we'll be back for a little bit, and then we'll go back over to Pledge Central. See how this all goes? It's great. It's all trying to end the fun drive, and we'll do that in good order. All right, let me introduce everybody, and then we'll start going on the issues of the moment. Jackie Berry is here, lecturer of cognitive sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, former Fulbright U.S. scholar to Egypt. Good morning, Jackie. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing good. How are you, Joe?
I'm well. Thank you very much. It's very, very nice to see you. I appreciate you being here.
Yep.
We also welcome Bo Breslin, Joseph Palamountain Jr. Chair in Government at there isn't a senior chair.
Yeah. True.
Just the chair in government at Skidmore College. And Bo, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Joe. 30 seconds. Can I have 30 seconds?
Absolutely.
So yesterday, super important day in the history of the United States. And it starts the most consequential 28 days in American history between now and July 4th. Yesterday in 1776, Richard Henry Lee, delegate from Virginia, stands up at the Second Continental Congress and proposes a resolution in three parts. And the first part was, let's declare independence. And the Second Continental Congress sits on it for a while. That's what they vote on it July 2nd. But that resolution is the most important resolution in American history and got the ball rolling towards independence on July 2nd. So the most consequential 28 days in American history started yesterday.
And now our consequential day is deal with the UFC.
Jefferson would have loved that.
Jim Ketter is Senior Fellow of the Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well and happy to be here and tackling the issues of the day as the roundtable does, and just want to urge people to support this so WAMC can continue doing what it does so well.
We really we need you. Thank you for that, Jim. Appreciate it. We need it. This is what we want to keep going and to continue to do what we do. So all you have to do is help out. WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. Pushy Prasad is here, the Arthur Zankel Chair in Management for Liberal Arts at Skidmore College, where she teaches international affairs and business management. Good morning. How are you?
I think I'm doing fine. I'm just realizing, since I'm new to this program, that it's encouraging my addiction to the news. I was always a news junkie. Now I have a sort of solid rationale to be so.
Yeah.
So
you have an outlet.
I have an outlet, and I have a moral justification.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. That's all good reasons, and you know.
So even addictive behaviors like this need to be supported. So please call WAMC.
You know, if you're going to get all worked up and upset about things, you might as well have a reason and an outlet to sort
right.
of present it to the world.
Put a microphone in front of you.
Right.
And yes.
Yeah. Call the sharing of the grievances. It's pretty great, I think. Okay, well, let's go to welcome all. It's, as I said, it's incredible to have all of you in one room, and I appreciate you being here. Now, let's go to what is happening. We look at Iran and Israel moving to de-escalate after ceasefire breaks down. After new attacks, Israelis lament a never-ending loop of war. With strikes against Israel, Iran aims to protect its regional gains. And no calm for Tehran's residents as Iran-Israel fighting resumes. Now, as far as this goes, Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps signaled that it had concluded its latest military operation against Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu pulled back from preparations for another attack after pushback from President Trump, according to two military officials. Iran and Israel signaled on Monday they were ready to wind down this escalation, which briefly shattered a fragile two-month ceasefire and brought the Middle East back to the precipice of a full-blown war. In remarks carried by Iranian state television on Monday afternoon, Iran's military said that it was ceasing its attacks for now, but it warned that if Israel resumed its own strikes, including in southern Lebanon, quote, much harsher and more forceful action than before will follow. Israel, for its part, I just lost my place. I was here for 2 seconds. How did I lose my place that easily? Israel, for its part, also appeared to be moving to de-escalate. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, after pushback from President Trump, instructed the military to halt preparations for another attack on Iran on Monday, according to two Israeli military officials. Netanyahu's office did not respond to a request for comment. The Israeli leader had yet to make any public remarks nearly a day into the crisis in which Israel and Iran traded attacks for hours. Mr. Trump on Monday called on both countries to, quote, immediately stop the attacks. He also promised that a final date to end the war in the Middle East was on the way, although the president's predictions of an agreement with Iran have frequently failed to materialize. Jim Ketter.
Well, I think the role of the roundtable panel is to not just talk about the headlines. People can read the headlines themselves, but to go beyond them and say, let's put this in some broader context. What do we really see going on here? And what does it mean for the United States? What does it mean in general? And I think what we see is a prelude of the Middle East to come for the next many years. And that is a region-wide conflict for supremacy between Iran and Israel. And the drawing in of a variety of other locations and power centers in that conflict, and also calling into question what is really the role of the United States. The U.S. has played an outsized role in relations across the Middle East since World War II. And if we see what is really happening now, it looks like that role is relatively diminished. And so the squaring off of these two regional powers against each other, that is, you know, maybe it's going to be on hold for the next day, maybe it's going to be on hold for the next month or two, but it's always going to be lurking and it's going to manifest itself in different ways and in different places. And so to say that, okay, the Iranians are no longer going to attack Israel and the Israelis aren't going to respond, that really is just one blip in time. And, you know, if we look across the region, we see what's going on in Lebanon, Israel's, you know, kind of relentless pounding of southern Lebanon, but also in and around Beirut, and the Iranians saying, well, this is our territory. The Hezbollah is our proxy. They're our ally. We're going to defend them. We also see that Yemen has been pulled into this and the Houthis. We see across the Middle East, after the October 23 attacks, Israel has really, you know, carried out a very aggressive foreign policy in a variety of places. They now hold over 50% of Gaza. It's not in the headlines anymore, but that's just the reality. The West Bank, we see daily series displacements and takeover of Palestinian land. As I said, Lebanon is being pounded. The Golan Heights have been annexed and settled. Syria, as Assad left, was attacked and really has been hollowed out as a state. The current government there really controls about 50% of the territory. We also have seen that Israel has set up bases in Iraq, which is really a very weakened state as well. And Iran, seeking to reach out to its proxies and to mobilize them. It's a very tenuous, very fragile peace. And, the U.S. has had one series of disasters after another, not just during the Trump administration, but there's multiple administrations who have their fingerprints on one foreign policy disaster after another in the region. And I think, people need to just take a deep breath and say, well, this is the Middle East we have now. This is the disastrous, catastrophic situation, particularly for the people who live there. Is there something the U.S. could do that would be more positive, or are we so weakened that we're essentially, kind of a Truth Social post and some phone calls, but really with relatively little effect?
Pushing.
Thank you so much for your very thoughtful introduction, Jim. I completely agree with you about the intense complexity of what is going on. And I would like to kind of even add to that or point out that there's a third player in this kind of tussle for the Middle East, which is Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia has for a long time seen itself as some kind of rival to Iran in controlling the Middle East. So you don't only have the countries you mentioned, you also have, not to mention all the UAE, the Gulf countries as well. So one of the things I'm kind of intrigued by, and I think it's worth thinking about, are some of these more backstage players, particularly the Gulf countries. And this war has affected them a great deal. I've been following Dubai more than anything else, and Dubai right now is almost unrecognizable as Dubai of 2 years ago. The Burj Khalifa, which is, their sort of monument of splendor, it's almost unoccupied now. I think it has something like a 20% occupancy. So I'm curious, seeing the kind of money and wealth that those Gulf countries have, is to think also about what kind of back... We don't hear too much about that. So what kind of backstage... They clearly are playing some kind of role. And so that's one thing. And the other thing I'd alert our listeners to is the role of upcoming elections in Israel. And again, I don't know how that's going to work out in the calculus that Israel or Netanyahu in particular makes in the near future. That's kind of my two cents here.
We'll take a quick pause. We welcome you to help out in the Lockbox panel, our WAMC.org. WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. And yes, panel at WAMC.org if you would like to write in and comment on on what we're talking about this morning. We will hear from Jackie Berry and Bo Breslin and continue our conversation after this short break.
Go out and tell a story. Let it echo far and wide. Make them hear you. Make them hear you. How justice was our battle and how justice was denied.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Little music from Joshua Henry from Ragtime, won the Tony last night, both for Joshua Henry as well as for a revival of musical. So cool. Congratulations. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We've been talking about what is going on in regards to Israel and Iran, and of course the United States and their input into all of this. Jackie Berry.
So thank you for your comments, Jim. You're right. The Mideast is not. What we have is not what we want right now, and you're right, Prishi, in the sense that Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf countries are kind of a wild card that we don't really know how that's going to land. From my perspective, it's been kind of a huge source of frustration that we've been negotiating on behalf of Israel by proxy. Phone calls between Trump and Bibi, that's it. Trump saying, well, I told him to stop bombing. That hasn't been working. And from my perspective, Netanyahu has been pursuing his agenda in Lebanon with impunity, doing what he wants there. And, you know, what makes that more ridiculous is that it's not like we've been doing a great job of negotiating. You know, we haven't brought our best people. I'm pretty sure the people who brokered the original JCPOA are still around and could have given some useful input. But no, we chose a couple of real estate guys. So, you know, it's not like we've put our best foot forward. So, you know, why are we doing this by proxy and we're not even doing that a great job ourselves through phone calls with the president? So I've, you know, wondered what is it going to take to get Israel, an Israeli delegation, to the negotiations table? And I'm sure Iran has wondered this as well. And maybe they decided that this was the best way to do that.
Boom.
Yeah. So let me build off of the august group here and the profound comments. Let me just play in contrast to Jim for a second, the small ball, the next, I don't know, week, month, maybe even 6 months. You know, there are at least seven major players that are sort of central to this particular moment, right? Not the long term, but this particular moment. And what I and I'll list the seven, but all seven of them have very different motivations for pathway forward, right? You're not, you talk about the obvious ones, Iran, Israel, and the U.S., very different motivations there. In some ways, I think David Sanger was right in that interesting article about a week ago where he said Iran is interested in sort of extending the conflict for a long time. They're not going to necessarily go to the negotiation table. Israel, Pushy's right, Israel's in a situation in which Likud is underwater. Bibi Netanyahu's, there just was a poll the other day that said that Bibi Netanyahu's party doesn't even have a coalition anymore if there was an election today. The U.S. is in a different situation, but there are at least four other organizations and governments that have a stake in this and have very different motivations. The Lebanese government has a very different motivation than Hezbollah, right? That's been well documented. The Gulf states, very different motivation. And I now see that Pakistan is back in the mix. They too have a different motivation. One of the things that's interesting about this this particular moment is Netanyahu is, it's clear that Netanyahu is getting pressure from inside to keep battering Hezbollah. Right. And he has to think about the ways in which his future depends on aggressive action in Hezbollah, maybe even in Beirut, but certainly south of the river. The one of the tragedies of this particular moment is that Israel tends often to over utilize military aggression as its approach. Right, I think getting to the table is not their first instinct. Their first instinct is militarily, and so their motivation, as I said, was different. I'll say a couple more things, and then I'll throw it open. Trump is being played at some level here. Iran wanted an emotional response from the missiles going to Israel in defense of Hezbollah, which is interesting in and of itself, because it's really the first time in a long time that Iran has said they want that they're you know, literally protecting proxies. They want an emotional response, and Trump gave them the emotional response. Stop bombing on Truth Social. So is the one question I'll leave open to the group is, every time we sort of, Trump identifies us as getting close to negotiation, I heard this on Al Jazeera today, so it's a little biased, but every time the American and Iranians get close to some sort of deal, there seems to be some military action that's stepped up on the part of Israel and Lebanon. Is Israel trying to sabotage? I don't know the answer to that, but the Al Jazeera people promote that, and I think it's an interesting question.
As far as this idea that I mentioned and in the article about the President of the United States once again saying that a peace deal is on the horizon and will be coming any day. And there is the obvious skepticism in that because of how many other deadlines we've had that have come and gone. But what do we make of that? And I guess I ask it in the spirit of what perhaps is he seeing that we are not seeing, in the sense of we look at what is happening in the world, the turmoil, the markets, everything, and then to suddenly say, yeah, we should be out of here by the end of the week.
I just have one answer to that, and then I'll leave it to the smarter people in the room. And that is, I don't think his shrugging his shoulders at the midterms is credible. I think he honestly believes that the American people don't like the war, and he's trying to sort of convince them that it's going to be done soon.
Pushy?
I'm just thinking, I can't help thinking that, you know, one of the things, Trump is almost a master at underestimating adversaries. I mean, in every respect, you know, first even in Minnesota, I mean, you know, these things are not entirely unconnected. So he's on to now what the Trump doctrine, or what some people are calling the Donro doctrine. And part of it does seem to be carry a big stick as big as possible and beat as many people with it, and that will get you something. So that's just not working. And I think he's actually a bit at a loss, frankly. I read somewhere in Foreign Affairs this whole idea of a short war fallacy, which powerful nations sometimes have, and that it seems like both the U.S. or the administration and Israel kind of fell into that. And now it's almost like, let's just get out of it because it's not fun, it's not working. And yeah, sure, they listen to us. And so there's almost this incurable optimism.
I don't think he really
accompanies things that are not necessarily optimistic.
Right. And I think that's how he looks at the world. I don't know that he necessarily Absolutely. Grasps the full context of everything that's going on. You know, does he even know everything that went into the original agreement that took place under the Obama administration? Probably not. And so from his perspective, and then also looking at the success in Venezuela, he probably thinks it was something mm-hmm. originally that could have been wrapped up pretty, you know, quickly, and now it's dragging. And then so, well, you know, in his mind, it's still something that can take place in a weekend or even a month, which is obviously not true.
I would just very gently push back on the idea that there was a success in Venezuela. We did apprehend the leader of Venezuela and put him in an American jail. But there was a lot of talk at the time about changing the regime. There was a lot of talk about undoing what had been an election that was fraudulent, and none of that happened. The regime is still in power. The mm-hmm. vice president of that was the product of ill-begotten election is still in power. The person who actually won the election has not been allowed to come back. The United States has done nothing for that and done nothing for the Venezuelan people to actually restore democracy. So I think what we also see is that the Trump administration, you know, instead of speaking softly and carrying a big stick, speaks loud and then really has very little capacity. And that's really one of the things that I think we need to understand, and it's even beyond the Trump administration, that the U.S. capacity doesn't match up with the talk. It doesn't Absolutely. Match up with the aspirations. And ultimately, the talk has very little value if you can't back it up with real capacity. And I think people are looking hard at us, including people in other places such as in Beijing and in Moscow.
I would like to add to that that, you know, speaking of the big stick is becoming a little weaker, it's a serious depletion of firepower,
yeah.
particularly the Tomahawk
right.
missiles,
yeah.
which
yeah.
actually take, I had no idea that they take so long to manufacture.
And
so
they
it's
cost
not
a
like
lot.
We can sort of, you know, snap one's fingers and they would be here tomorrow, so.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with this wonderful panel, Jackie Berry, Bo Breslin, Jim Ketterer, and Pushy Prasad. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, WAMC.org, to help us during the fund drive. We'll be right back. Good morning. Listening to Tony Award-winning music from Ragtime. Tony's were last night. I'm sure when Madeline and I are on at 11, we'll talk a little bit about the Tonys last night. So rest easy. we are obviously watching the totals come in, and we have a couple things here. We have a great panel. I'll reintroduce them to you in just a second. The two things that we want to make note of, one is we are a couple thousand dollars away from getting to the $1,025,000 point, and that is very significant. We are there, and if we do that, we're almost there. If we do that, we make $7,000. We get that unlocks $7,000. So we ask you to help out in any way, shape, or form. That's from Anonymous. $7,000, 1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. We also have this very cool one-for-one match for new members. Francis in Scotia is a sustaining member, making an additional contribution because WAMC is the most important part of my day, Francis says. So they have a match for new members, and we will get $1,000 if we get $1,000 from new members. So that's cool. That's very, very cool. So all of that going on, we'll update you. WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. Jackie Berry is here, lecturer of cognitive sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Beau Breslin, Joseph Palamountain Jr. Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Jim Ketterer, Senior Fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement. And Pushy Prasad, who is the Arthur Zankel Chair in Management for Liberal Arts at Skidmore College. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. All right, we go now to another big story, and this is, it's funny. Well, it's not funny, but I was going to say, every time the president walks out of an interview, we seem to want to talk about it, and I think this is significant in its own way because of the way it happened, and again a female reporter who was rudely interrupted by the president, and then walked out in the middle of Kristen Welker's Meet the Press interview that aired Sunday. Kristen Welker challenged the president's false claims about elections and the January 6th, 2021 riot at the U.S. Capitol. Trump said, "Let's call it quits because I've had enough," he said after a tense exchange lasting about 4 minutes. "Thank you, darling. Have a good time." He then stood up and walked off the set in a barn in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, taped before an event focused on farmers that Trump held there on Friday. An NBC spokesperson declined to comment. The White House did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Kristen Welker had a lot to say about it, but that's to be expected. Trump appeared to become agitated when Welker asked him about the $1.8 billion fund he has sought to pay people claiming they were victims of politicized prosecutions. The Justice Department agreed to set up the fund to settle the president's lawsuits against the IRS, but officials backed off amid court challenges and pushback from Republican senators. The president said on Meet the Press that he still wanted to establish the fund, that he has not given that up, even though Todd Blanch, I believe, said that he was going to give that up. "If it was up to me, I'd pay them the kind of money that they deserve," he said. "If they get it approved, that's great. If they don't get it approved, I will be disappointed." Welker pressed Trump specifically on whether the 172 people who pled guilty to assaulting police officers during the January 6th attack would be eligible for money. Trump declined to rule it out, arguing that FBI agents invited the rioters inside the Capitol and that people pleaded guilty only because they were afraid of harsher sentences. Welker pointed out that there is no evidence of FBI agents ushering those people into the Capitol, rioters inside of the Capitol. The Justice Department's Inspector General found that four FBI informants entered the building, but not at officials' direction, and no on-duty agents were on the Capitol grounds that day until some responded to help subdue the riot. This still being litigated all these years later. The people were destroyed by dirty cops and by weaponization, Trump said. Many of these people should be compensated. He then alleged that the 2020 presidential election and last week's California primary were rigged. Welker said there was no evidence to support those claims either. Trump said that taking days to finish counting ballots, which continues in California following Tuesday's primary, proved his assertion. Under California law, mail ballots postmarked by Election Day can still be accepted for up to a week. She asked him, "What is your evidence?" He said, "All I have to do is look." And Welker said, "Is that evidence?" And it was shortly thereafter that he got unlocked. Bo.
Joe, you know, I think there are a couple of things that I'll throw out to the group here. One is sort of this new, at least at the presidential level, it's new, what I call the Brett Kavanaugh style of politics, right? That is, remember when Kavanaugh was quite frankly, I think rightfully accused of sexual assault. And his response, which if you remember those confirmation hearings, his response was to be aggressive, angry, you know, raise his voice. And somebody told him, some team of folks told him during the break, Brett Kavanaugh, to approach politics that way. And it was successful, right? He gets confirmed. I remember sitting there, and I'll stop talking about Kavanaugh in a second, but I remember sitting there watching his response and thinking, wow, he has imploded his candidacy for the Supreme Court, and yet it was successful. I think this is one of the great tragedies of the current American politics, is that you go hard if you've been confronted, and here Trump is going hard if he's been confronted. I'll say that that's one thing. Two is talking about the politics of ballot counting. One of the things that is frustrating is I think we all still live in the shadow of not Florida in 2000, I won't say that, but Iowa a few years ago in the caucus, where they just had a debacle. Remember that, Joe? Yeah. Iowans.
Yes.
Yeah. It took weeks for that Iowa
to
figure it out.
It was a new system. Nobody knew what they were
right.
doing. Nobody. They asked the election commissioners, and they said, "Well, we're reviewing the rules."
Exactly, and I think people remember. I remember growing up in an environment in which voting, counting votes. For most of the 21st century, for sure, has been almost instantaneous.
I will say that I, of someone of interest in political science, I have read entire books on the Iowa caucus, and I have yet to understand it.
Wow.
Like, right? I mean, it is.
Well,
like,
it is a wacky.
It's
form.
A wacky system.
Totally.
Yeah. So the fact that could go awry right. seems like not completely out of the realm for me.
Right. And I think that, I mean, that's an important related question about whether or not the caucus is a good idea to begin with.
Right.
But it all of a sudden threw into doubt what was a very sort of. I think probably people were confident about Iowa caucus and so on. And nowadays, if there's any hint that there's counting that's going to be delayed, it's automatically seen, especially on the right, as being fraudulent. That, I think, these are the new realities of American politics. I've got a lot more to say, but I'll stop there.
Pushy.
It's interesting, though, that when the right or the Republicans or Trump wins, how is it that there is no corruption only at that moment? So it doesn't make sense. And I'd just be curious as to how do people receive that? I mean, that's the first thing you want to ask, right?
Yeah.
How come when your candidate wins, there's no corruption, but otherwise it's almost always fraudulent?
There assumes a certain rationality in the way in which we're analyzing American politics,
okay, so,
and there isn't these days.
So that's where we're going, I guess. So even all, I mean, a lot of this is performative. even walking out of interviews, but it clearly holds a lot of appeal. I don't know the people who it appeals to. I did a little experiment on my own the last few weeks. It so happens I've been having things done to my yard and little repairs here and there. And so I talked to the people who do this work. By the way, there were four of them. Someone who came to measure the carpets, all four white men. They were distinctly skeptical of the entire process, but none of them... The skepticism seemed to be founded on some kind of rationality. And I think that's where what you're saying, I mean, it's either evidence of certain things happening and going wrong, or their own personal plight, really, particularly with regards to healthcare, which they see both parties as not doing anything or sufficiently for them. And if you're a small entrepreneur, the Obama law actually doesn't help you. And so in the absence or in the presence of such skepticism, I wonder if the performativity does kind of find some sort of a space, is sort of what I'm saying.
Yes. Jackie? Yeah, it is performative. And I remember that. Like, I remember Kavanaugh coming back after a break and he came out swinging. He came out swinging.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there thinking he's imploded his candidacy. I was sitting there thinking the level of entitlement that somebody who's accused of assaulting another person can sit there and just think that they should be excused or exonerated or, you know, whatever they're thinking should be happening while they are trying to become a part of the highest court in the land. It was just shocking to me. It was just shocking to me.
And sort of, and obviously there's not a direct link, but it gives us, it was sort of the beginning of us getting used to that Hegsethian way of answering questions in a really irked manner of how dare you ask me such a stupid question about why we bomb those people.
Well, so aside from Trump's behavior in this, and it's not that surprising, I guess, but it's still shocking that this is the president of the United States behaving that way. But put that aside, what I'd like to focus on is what he was really focused on, what got him upset. And what he was focused on is what he has been saying for 6.5 years, and he's really been ramping it up in the last few months, and that is about the legitimacy of elections and the legitimacy of election results.
Absolutely.
And I'm just continuously surprised that I see these two parallel things. There's Trump, who was just saying this constantly, not just in this interview, but over and over and over again, and talking about 2020, I think has everything to do with setting the stage of what's going to happen this November.
Sure.
And so there's that going on. And he's saying out loud.
Yes.
He's many things, but he is not subtle. And he often is just telegraphing very clearly what he is going to do, not just to the body politic in general, but to his supporters. He's saying to them, stand ready and stand by. And at the same time, I know many people who just kind of think that what we're involved in here is normal politics. We're going to have normal elections in the midterms, and that, you know, if the Democrats can win the House and maybe the Senate, then things will kind of go back to normal. They're dreaming. Mm-hmm. They're absolutely dreaming to think if that is the case, what happened on January 6th in 2021 is going to be like a Boy Scout jamboree compared to what is to happen this fall.
Right.
I think we are going to see a complete meltdown, and it is going to be excruciatingly violent and very dangerous. And he's telegraphing this already. He's just saying this is what's going to happen. And if we look at the actions that support what he's saying, they have worked very hard to put complicit and compliant election officials in place, which he didn't have in 2020. The Department of Justice is gathering all kinds of election data from the states. And unclear what they're doing with this, but this is not normal behavior. There are purging of election rolls that are already happening. The voter ID stuff, the constraints on mail-in voting, all of this. And then pardoning all of the January 6th criminals, people who were convicted of criminal behavior and now saying that they will be rewarded with a financial payout one way or another sends a signal not just to them but to anybody else who might be mobilized. And so I just think that there is a failure of imagination to understand the immediacy, the urgency, and the danger of what we are steaming toward. It is highly dangerous for any political system. If this were any other country, it weren't the United States of America, and I were working on it, and as I have with elections around the world, this would be red lights flashing, very dangerous situation, highly likely to implode.
Let me add, I think you're absolutely right, Jim. Let me add one more thing. So there's this, came out in early 2000s, a really, really important book by a woman named Michelle Alexander. It's called The New Jim Crow.
Of course, yeah.
And her argument is that incarceration of, in particular, African-American men, but incarceration of people of color is the new Jim Crow, right? So she's tracing slavery to Jim Crow, to incarceration as a way of controlling a particular ethnic group, a particular racial group, in this case, African-American men. You can make the argument, Jim, I'm just adding to what you're saying. One can make the argument that the increased attention paid to black and brown people in the criminal justice system under the Trump administration is a continuation of what Michelle Alexander is talking about. Because, of course, everybody who is a felon, right, without getting pardoned, everybody who's a felon is no longer on the voting rolls. And so there are ways in which some of the ways in which racial law enforcement at the national level, I'm talking about ICE, is a continuation of controlling black and brown people, and in particular, influencing and affecting the democratic process.
I have to say, Jim, I find your discussion terrifying and probably very true. And I myself am guilty of kind of reverting to this, you know, well, something's going to happen in the elections. And, you know, Bo and I have a retired colleague who's from Chile, and she grew up during the, you know, Pinochet. And she always says to me, you're a very smart person. She said, whether she's right or that's a different thing. I know you do all this stuff very well. She said, you have never lived through a dictatorship. Mm-hmm. And this is absolutely true. And so I don't see you're right. I don't see the actual, or I tend to kind of think it will be over. I will say the most terrifying thing that I experienced this weekend, and the Washington Post has reported this, is the attempt by, Interior Department to get 6,000 people declared as dead on the Social Security files. They were all immigrants of some sort. And we have a whistleblower, his name escapes me right now, but he has come out and pointed out that they were actually planning to declare people who are alive, and many of them are permanent residents. Not many, but several. And some are even U.S. citizens. So that does tell you of what they believe is legitimate and what they're capable of doing. In this case, it didn't work out.
You know, and it seems to me that the president sees these elections, and I think rightly so, in his analysis, as existential for him.
Absolutely.
And that he knows that if one or two of the houses flip, there'll be more impeachment proceedings, there'll be investigations, there'll be all kinds of things that will happen. So it's not like he could just kind of take a loss and then say, like, oh, well, you know, well, we'll continue on. And, you know, well, often many presidents lose midterm elections and then they figure out a way to go forward. He's seeing this in a completely different way, and he's saying it out loud. Over yeah. and over and over again.
Yeah, they're going to impeach me.
Yeah. He's not trying to. He's not trying to disguise it. You're right. He's just saying it. He's telegraphing it out loud, in the moment, ad hoc. And the idea of trying to pay people who committed these criminals, I think I like that you just put it so just directly like that. It's just so incredulous to me that I don't even know that I can completely wrap my mind around it. So they. they beat up police officers, right? They vandalized, they stole. I mean, and then they're tying it to this precedent of Native Americans who were given settlements during the Obama administration because of several rulings about something about the federal government had mismanaged funds. And there was a series of rulings that took place during the Obama administration. So that's what they've cited as the justification for this anti-weaponization fund. So first of all, that argument doesn't hold water. It is a complete false equivalency. In this case, they would be paying people who broke the law, beat police officers, and if that were not bad enough, tried to prevent the peaceful transfer of power. If we are not anything in this country as U.S. Americans, we have peaceful transfer of power. That is one of the hallmarks and the cornerstones of having a democracy. And they tried to stop it, and you're going to compensate them for that.
Yeah, and one more thing, like, Jackie's so right. And then all of the sudden, you know, you're in a situation in which the Republican senators actually decide not to take it up, right? They're the $1.8 billion thing. And somehow that's the greatest triumph of statesmanship in the history of the United States, right?
Profiles like, and courage.
Profiles and yeah. courage, right? And yet they're unwilling to completely write into the law, completely eliminate the $1.8 billion. So Trump can sit there and say, I think it's a good idea.
You know, it's things that strike you. All the points you made are just so brilliant, but it's just things that strike you. This weekend, my wife and I are planning a trip in the fall for, and we want to go to a bunch of national parks.
Yeah.
And it seems like a good time. America 250. I'm excited. A lot of things that we don't, that we haven't seen. I'm a couple states short of having seen them all, so I'm making my list. And so we went on to the we went on to the national park page to get a pass for multiple parks over time. Two things struck me. One, the Trump George Washington pass. He is on the pass for to see. Yes, I'll show you a picture. But the thing that struck me too is it's that's $80, and then you can go to multiple parks over the year. Non-resident annual pass $250. Yeah. I mean, what are we doing? And I just there's something about the normalcy, the normalization of this, of something as simple as going to our parks as if, I mean, there's a difference between who sees them and looks at them and has to pay more to go to them. I don't know. It's fundamentally seems just taking away what this whole thing is supposed to be about.
Yeah. It's so true. And the fact is, Joe, you're right about that. And in the next, I don't know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, the Supreme Court will come out with a birthright citizenship case. There are ongoing litigation around immigration. I think of all the guests that, Joe, that you have that are experts in this particular area. America was founded on the principle of liberty. And if you're on our soil, you are treated with the dignity and respect that regardless of where you came from, and that is being thrown out and indicative of the three times more you have to pay to get in a national park if for some reason you're not a white bred American.
Trump also on the military pass as well, just for the record.
And the $250 bill. Eventually.
Coming soon to a bank near you. Real quick, I want to update you on where we are as far as the money goes. If you we're gonna come back in just a few minutes and continue on the fund drive. We are looking to get to the $1,025,000 point. And if we do that, Anonymous will give us $7,000, which is very cool. Anonymous says, get to the $1,025,000 point, and you are we'll give you $7,000. We're $1,900 away from that. $1,900. So whatever you can do, WAMC.org, WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. My thanks to our wonderful panel this morning. We weird timings, but I'm glad we got so much in, and I thank you all for being here. Jackie Berry, Bo Breslin, Jim Ketterer, and Pushy Prasad, I thank you so much for being here. You're all wonderful. Thank you. We'll be back with more from Fun Drive Central and news with Ray Graff coming up after this.